6 a.m. front door comes through, guns pointed at me and everything.
Welcome, Tyrone.
Thanks, Matt. Very, very kind. Thank you for having me.
Tell us where it all begins.
I was an estate agent for years on the high street. I loved the job until I hit that sort of plateau. I was running the office at a very young age, had a company car, but for me, it just was never enough.
When you got caught with intent to supply, had you already been doing stuff prior at that point?
It had been going on for about 4 years. I definitely tried to fast track a result the wrong way. I sometimes look at it in disbelief. God, was I actually there? I spent my 30th birthday inside.
You're out of prison, you're working for an estate agent, you've got your tag on.
Yeah.
When does the tag come off and when do you start your own business?
They were putting limits on what I could do, and that was where I realised that this wasn't the right company for me. I looked around, it just didn't exist. And what I ended up doing was creating a solution to my own problems. It exploded. We were over 100 agents within 6 months.
Hey, Matt Haycock's here with a quick interruption just to say, I hope you're liking the show, but please, please like, subscribe or comment. That's how we can bring you better guests. That's how we can make the show better each week. So please, please, that's all I ever ask of you. We never charge. We never ask anything else. Just please give us a few moments of your time. Guys, Matt Haycock's here and welcome to another episode of Stripping Off with Matt Haycock's, where we strip off our guests. Figuratively speaking, don't worry. And we go deep on money, business and life. And today I have got the king of real estate with me. He has been on the TV show Mega Mansion Hunters. He is the UK's number one followed real estate agent on Instagram. Welcome, founder and owner of the Tyrone Ash real estate business. Welcome, Tyrone.
Thanks, Matt. Very, very kind. Thank you for having me.
It's a very excited intro that I'm excited with.
Yeah, excited with this episode.
But tell me, you weren't always the king of real estate. I think when you were working in an estate agency in your earlier years, you've gone down the wrong path. You've ended up being convicted of an intent to supply a class A drug. I think you've got a prison sentence as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we can start there. We can start a bit earlier if you want. Just tell us where it all begins.
I think like it's been kind of probably, when I look back at it, it's been a bit of a staggering journey, because I sometimes look at it in disbelief and think, God, was I actually there? I spent my 30th birthday inside and was released like 3 months later. And it was a real eye-opener. But a lot of my big kind of life decisions got made in that period, where I knew that I had to sort myself out. I had to get myself focused on where I needed to go. And I didn't actually realize or envisage what I was actually capable of until I actually focused like that. So that was the most interesting thing about it. It was really, really strange to think that I was ever in that position. It's like looking at it through a window at somebody else. It doesn't feel like it's me. So I was an estate agent for years on the high street. So I was always the top salesman, always doing what was required.
Got just working for someone else at this
high
point.
High street agencies, yeah. And that's how I left school. I knew I didn't want to go to university. I know I didn't want to study. I love trying to make money. I love putting deals together. And for me, it was very much like, well, going to sales, like going to property. My dad was buying a few buy-to-lets and stuff, knew the estate agents. So that's how I got in there. And I loved the job until I hit that sort of plateau where I was running the office at a very young age, like 22, 23, had a company car that was kind of admired by everyone. But for me, it just was never enough. And I guess I just got a lot of frustration spill over when I wasn't really achieving what I believed I could achieve. And from there, it led me down different paths, and I ended up making some pretty silly decisions to try and, effectively just to try and make money.
And greed, is it that really?
It's a good question, because is it greed? I think that like my answer is no. I think that often a lot of the times people go down the wrong paths. There are people that make very bad decisions, unforgivable decisions. There are some people who frustration boils over. And for me, it was never greed. It was frustration and
impatience.
And I think I definitely tried to fast track a result the wrong way. And that was what my rebellious side kind of came out. And there I was, and the chickens came home to roost, as they say.
I mean, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but it was kind of setting me up for a second question. But when you got caught with intent to supply, had you already been doing stuff prior at that point?
Yeah, I mean, it'd been going on for about 4 years.
So, and I guess the reason I ask the question then is because you know, we talk about the impatience to fast track to something better, but then do you think that's also maybe an excuse as well, that if you hadn't have been caught, you'd have still been doing it and still been doing it, because ultimately what kind of, once you get that taste, you probably slip into that world and the easy money probably lasts, you know, you think it lasts forever.
Yeah, I think that, like, I was extremely guilty of being attracted to fast money instead of proper money. And that meant that I would always have a few thousand pounds on the hip, but I never actually was building anything of substance, anything of value. And that in itself is dangerous, because it's a repeating cycle. It reloads itself every single week. You get that cash on the hip, you throw a few bottles of champagne around in the club on a Saturday, and then you're back to square one on Monday. And that's kind of how my life was. And you know, it was stupid. It was a bubble that, you know, you fool yourself into thinking is the real world. And then when you actually get out into the real world and you realize how business works, you realize how real people actually operate, you realize just how deluded you were in trying to make that work for yourself on any kind of a long-term platform.
Had you picked up any of your own properties at this point? You had started to buy some buy-to-lets?
Yeah, I had three buy-to-lets under my name. One of them actually got repossessed because I wasn't making the payments. The other two I sold recently, so yeah.
And I mean, tell me about that arrest day. You know, I mean, I assume you were never expecting it. You sat at home, the door gets kicked in?
Yeah, it was. I think I did feel it coming. A few people around me had been arrested. It was coming, and for me, it was just a foolishness, because I actually didn't know what else to do. So I just carried on riding my luck. And then at 6 a.m., front door comes through, and I'm, you know, guns pointed at me and everything, and then I get put into the police car. And there it was. And then I was on bail for about a year, 12 months.
On bail, not on remand?
No. I was on bail. And yeah, that was probably torturous in itself, because you know what's coming. It's not like you go into meeting with your solicitor and then the solicitor goes, oh, don't worry, what we're going to do is say this, this and this. It was like first meeting, yeah, you're looking at 3 years. I was like, what? 3 years? Like, having that news the first time was like, I can't even explain to you the feeling I got in my stomach, because regardless of whether you should be getting that sentence or you shouldn't be getting that sentence, getting the news that that's going to happen is like the most shocking bit of news you could ever receive. And for me, it was horrendous. And so living with that cloud over your head for like 12 months, rehabilitating yourself early. My dad was a bit more old school. He wanted my brother to be a plumber, which he was at the time, and me to be an electrician. So I went and did an electrical course, got my qualification while I was on bail, started doing work that way. And of course, the court cases were coming up and all this sort of stuff. And then I got slammed with 40 months. I thought it was very harsh for what it was, but it is what it is. You know, stupid points get stupid prizes, I guess is the saying.
And at what point then from that arrest did you decide to rehabilitate, as you use the word? You know, what point did you kind of realise this had to be the end and I've got to be a new guy?
I think for me, it was very much at the start. It was the day that the front door came in. I just wanted out. I had this weird sense of relief when it happened, even though I was absolutely terrified, because I didn't know how it was going to end. I didn't know what my door out was. I didn't know whether I could build a career. I got so lost in it that the relief of never having to do it again was weirdly satisfying, even though I was absolutely terrified. So
were you still operating as an estate agent while you were doing it?
No, you stopped there. I just gone gung-ho into it, and that was it.
It wasn't your side hustle.
No, it started off a side hustle. It did, yeah. It started off a side hustle, and then it just kind of escalated into, oh, this is easy, quick money. I'll just do this and go and sit in the gym for 4 hours a day. It was quite easy.
And what did you do in prison? I mean, you know, how did you try and get through the days? You know, did you plan your new life after your release?
I think I really found prison hard mentally, because I consider myself an extremely smart person. I am well educated, well spoken. I understand a lot of general knowledge. I understand what's going on in the world, in a lot of different areas, politically, economically, everything. So to have this active brain be confined to an environment where you are told when your door gets unlocked, you're told when you have breakfast, when you have lunch, when you have dinner, who you can sit with, who you can room with, when you can exercise, and you have to do it all without a mobile phone, and it's all confined and it's mapped out and you have no control over it. Your name pretty much disappears and it gets replaced with a number. That for me, for my brain, was very, very hard to take. There are people in there that thrive. There are people in there that make more friends, make more contacts, and it becomes like a little mini holiday for them, especially if they come from very, very poor communities. Getting 3 square meals a day and a bed with new bed sheets on it every single day is actually a luxury for a lot of people in this world. And I could see that firsthand, just how poor and deprived some people were in there. It was pretty much like being locked in the worst council estate you've ever imagined in your life, but you couldn't get off it. It was terrible.
I mean, that disconnect from the outside world, I think, is what would do me. We can't even begin to compare, but I know what I'm like on an 8-hour flight with no Wi-Fi, you know, feeling that, you know, things are going on without me. I'm not getting my WhatsApps, you know. I mean, never mind, you know, going a week in today's world, a month, you know, what's your missus up to? What the kids up to? I mean, you go fucking nuts.
You go absolutely crazy. Your mind is the biggest battle that you have to overcome. If you were dating anyone and then you've gone in there and weeks and months pass, you know the worst, you fear the worst, you expect the worst.
Did you have a missus or anything when you went in?
I had a girlfriend at the time that was kind of on and off at the time. And I'd already accepted in my head, I was like, that's done. My parents were like, oh, do you want her to come visit? I was like, no. I don't want her to visit. I don't want anything. Like, I went into a real hole though, like mentally there, where I was so annoyed with myself that it had come to this. So I started reading a lot of books.
They got good access to books in prison.
Yeah, I was getting books sent in though. They've got some okay ones, but nothing that's going to help you really, you know, reinvigorate your entire life.
It wasn't a book with a spoon in it, was it, like in Shawshank Redemption? Yeah.
I did think about it. I think the problem was, is escaping wouldn't quite give me the foundation I'd be looking for outside. But it was about getting control of my brain. My brain was running riot. And I become very antisocial there. So I didn't mix with a lot of people. I maybe spoke to 2 people in there. I kept myself to myself. I wasn't trying to make friends. It's a bit like being in a high school for adults. It's like you've got the people who are into their sports and their gym and, gym orderlies and all this. You get the kind of bookworm librarian type people that hang around the library. And then you get the real, you know, scumbags that are in there. And they will literally, you know, rob anything that's not nailed down. And it reminds me a lot of how school was, the interactions. And funny enough, you'll never realize just how adolescent adults' brains are until you get into a place like that. Most grown men are like children and they operate like children. They can't even groom, dress themselves. They can't make themselves a cup of tea. They don't know how to operate in normal life. And it's quite amazing when you actually see it in real action, just how damaged society is, and that is one hell of a window that you see in there. So it was a real eye-opener.
What books were you reading? Can you remember any titles?
Yeah, my mum sent me one called The Power of the Subconscious Mind. That was a really good one. That started making me write affirmations down. Now, I'm not a super superstitious person I don't approach business that way. However, you haven't really got much else to do. So you kind of have to just write plans out, write goals out, write what you want to achieve out. And before you know it, there was a shelf like that I would lie looking up at the bottom of, which was above my bed. And it just had post-it notes of everything that I was going to achieve when I got out of there. I used to write them every day. I used to repeat them 100 times over and over and over again. I used to start training and conditioning my brain for achievement.
What were some of those goals?
I wanted a supercar. I said I was going to buy myself a supercar one day. I had dreams of having a Lamborghini when I was a sales negotiator. I had a picture of a black Lamborghini on my desk when I was working at Connell's estate agents in Bletchley. God knows how many terrace houses I'd have had to sell to get that. But, you know, that was my goal. And I still had that goal in my head. I wanted to, you know, hit £1 million. I wanted to have self-worth. I wanted to get myself, I wanted to get further in business. I had all these things written down. And I would write the same things down over and over again. It was like a repetitive process. And I remember like people coming into the cell and seeing these notes on the bottom of my shelf and just saying like, you know, what's this? And they're like ribbing me a little bit for it. And I just thought, well, you know, for me, I'm either going to start beating myself up for the next 12 months or I'm going to start conditioning my brain to do something. And by the time I got out, it was, I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't know what my plan was. I actually went through the whole of the sentence thinking I was going to be an electrician because that's what I was trained in. I started doing it. I was a terrible, terrible electrician. And it was only when I started flirting with the idea of getting back into property, because that's what I was good at. I was a very good salesperson, very good at estate agent at the time or before. And then it kind of just presented itself with an opportunity. I started working at a company in North London.
An estate agency.
Yeah. And they were selling luxury property. What they didn't realize was I was still on tag. And I used to have to get home by 9 o'clock. And I'd have a really bulky looking sock on my right foot. And I was listing and selling some big houses. And I was, and I loved that job. And that's where my love for property kind of really invigorated itself. And I become very, very good at it.
Did you ever have any formal sales training?
I have been through a few different sales training courses that were put up by companies. I've never really sat through courses, to be honest. The reason being is real estate for me is not a straight sell. So what I find is that it's a combination of a lot of skills. So you've got to be an excellent marketer. You've got to be an excellent relationship builder, an excellent networker. You've also got to be very methodical. You've got to be able to do research, data, all of these things, present a case, present a presentation, whatever it might be. And then you've got to be able to close. So it's kind of like when I started training myself in real estate, what I realized was I was very, very good at closing a contract and getting something done. But the methodical side of it, the research, the data, the pound per square foot evidence, all that stuff, I was a bit slapdash with it because I didn't enjoy that. That was too process driven. So I got really into the nooks and the crannies of that, of how to do it and how to be an expert at it. And that served me very, very well as I put the whole thing together. I've been on Tony Robbins' Unleash the Power Within seminar. I've gone through Jordan Belfort's sales training course. There's a few others in there that slipped my mind, but I've done a few. I do like the art of selling a lot, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I you know, I've read a bit on sales. Never been on any courses. You know, read a few bits, and you know, sometimes when I'm talking to someone about something, and it's someone I know, they might be taking the piss a bit. Going, oh God, you're such a fucking salesman, you know. Mm. And I always say, I actually don't believe I could be any less a salesman, but I just think, like, you know, my, let's say, two skills or particular areas. I mean, one skill is in relationship building, but then the other thing that I think I bring to selling is an absolute belief in my product. Mm. And I think if you can build a relationship and you truly believe in your product, then ultimately it sells itself. I mean, I think maybe the skilled salespeople are the ones who can sell absolute shite. I mean, you know, yeah. I don't think I could sell something that I don't believe in. Yeah. I mean, any business I've ever had has either been a product that I do genuinely use anyway, that I am the customer for, or a product that I would be a customer of should I fit into that demographic. Mm. You know, I've never sold something disingenuously. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, yeah, if you can build a relationship and if you truly love what you do or love what you sell, then you're 90% of the way there.
I couldn't agree more. I think that the days of being a kind of hit and run double glazing salesperson are becoming a lot more obsolete now because there is a lot more involved with a sale. I think also, especially a product or service of serious value, when you're talking about, for example, I can relate it to real estate, you know, getting that contract signed of someone to list their house for £2 million, and let's just say they've got to pay us a fee of 2.5%, which is £50,000. 50 grand of anyone's money is not a small amount of money. So for them to entrust us with that process, there's got to be a few boxes ticked. The first thing is the relationship and the likability has got to be there. They've got to trust you and like you. If they don't trust you and like you, ain't getting the business. It doesn't matter if it's the best pitch in the world. The second thing is the process has got to be a process that they believe is going to work, and also that you believe and deliver it in a way where they are going to understand it's going to work. Because it's one thing saying, this is great. I always call it the so what factor. If you say something which could be a feature or a benefit to somebody, they might like the sound of it, but if they can't fully understand, resonate exactly what it means to them and how it's going to benefit them, then that also becomes a redundant process, because you're just shouting facts. If someone can say, right, well, if I instruct you to sell my home, this process that you've just gone through with every incremental detail is going to attract 10 times more buyers than a high street agent's going to attract. The process of the open house and the multiple block viewings is going to attract a lot more competition into the process. And then you being the expert negotiator that you are going to negotiate the price to the highest possible level. What that does is it kind of binds the whole process together. And then they're going to go, yeah, that's the person who's going to sell my house. And then the 2.5% fee is very easy to close compared to the 1% fee the high street's charging, because their process doesn't compare with that. And the so what factor is all that process means, this person's going to sell my house and they're going to sell it for the best possible price. So I'll pay the fee.
So back in the UK, because I know you've got businesses on both countries now. Back in the UK, you charge a 2.5% sales fee, do you?
Really? Sole agency.
I mean, I was going to come on to talk about, talk about the UK market versus the Dubai market later on, but maybe we'll just pick up on this now. So I always hear people, I've lived in America as well, so I've experienced the real estate market over there where commissions are, 6%, yes. split two ways, certainly 5%. And, people always pull a face about it and, oh, these commissions are ridiculous. And, my simplistic view is, like with anything in your life, you get what you pay for.
Yep.
And yes, they're chunky commissions, but when you look at US real estate agents, or when you look at Dubai real estate agents, okay, fine, there'll always be some charlatans around, but in general, the charlatans, because they're hungry people who know that there's enough money on the table to go and get paid. So, so they put the effort in. Yes, they might be hounding you, but they're hounding you because, there's a sale to be made and there's money to be had. You look at a UK real estate agent, they just don't give a fuck.
Because
it's a 1% commission, probably chipped to 0.75.
Yeah.
To the agency, whereas the person who's dealing with you is probably an employee of that who's getting, £100 bonus or something if he makes a sale. There's just no money in it to incentivize people. No. In the same way that, you complain about the service in your restaurants in England, well, we don't fucking pay them any money and we don't want to tip them either. You go to America, it's not a shameful thing to be a career waiter. You can be
a
waiter all your life earning a six-figure salary, because people tip, because people pay, and, we're going back to that, you get what you pay for. But how do you, because you must be very unusual, charging 2.5%, how do you make that sale in a business which is normally a race for the bottom?
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant question, and it's one that we cover in our training heavily in the business. The most simplistic way that I would put it is that you don't send a boy in to do a man's job. And for me, if you are looking to sell what is arguably your biggest asset, you need the person who is the most skilled to deliver the best possible result. So everyone can come in and say, I'm the greatest estate agent, I'm going to sell your home. That's fine. But if you actually demonstrate, first of all, that side of it, your ability, your certainty in yourself, certainty in your ability, your results of what you've done and what the business has done to show that we can do this. Secondly, the process. So it's one thing being a great hit and run salesman, as we called it, but what's your process? What's the actual tangible process that's attached to that? Okay, so we're going to attract far more leads through social media. We're going to get far more views, far more click-throughs. We're going to get far more buyer leads come through the property portals. We're going to get short, medium, and long form content done to attract far more buyer leads through different platforms in addition to all of that. Then what we've got is a process where we're going to drive buyers into a competitive environment. We're going to make sure that the property gets multitude of buyers through the door on a selected open house or viewing weekend. And then here's the evidence where we've shown other properties on a national scale, where we have shown that we deliver this process, not only just a fresh new listing, we're talking about stuff that's been on the market for 2-3 years of time with failed estate agents who are charging 1%. We've gone in, delivered the process, delivered the proper pricing strategy, the marketing strategy, the negotiations. We've driven 30, 40, 50 buyers through the door over 2 weekends, got 10 offers on the table, and we've delivered a sale in 3-4 weeks when this was on for 12 months with other agents. That's how the process works. But if you want that service, it's 2.5%. If you want me to just come in with my phone and take a few photos, stick it on Rightmove for any price that you want and just hope we get some wood on the ball, sure, I'll do it for 0.5%, no problem.
But are you going to get me a higher price that's going to effectively absorb your extra commission anyway?
Well, I always think that the extra commission is based on, I mean, if you put it into poundage terms, right, let's just work on, I don't know, £1 million.
It's £1 million house, so I'm either paying 10 grand or I'm paying 25 grand.
So,
do you think you can get me that extra 15 grand?
£15,000 in £1 million is a drop in the ocean. And funny enough, the process attached to what is what I would call a very, very mundane process in selling with a high street agent or someone of that level of skill, you're not only going to be thinking you're saving on the fee, but you're going to be losing a dramatic amount of value in your property based on the fact the process is not designed to get you the highest possible price. So you might think you're saving on the fee by £15,000, but you're probably going to lose 10, 15% of your house value because they don't have a strategy attached to it. So what we've got is it's a measurable strategy that you can literally monitor on facts, figures, data, and you can actually then drive that into the end result with how many buyers has it generated, unlimited amounts of case studies of where this has been successful. And then we say, look, and I'll often finish on the fact that, you know, the one thing you've got is there's a process that I've demonstrated, which is absolutely, you know, top drawer, but you've also got the best negotiator in the industry driving your price to the highest possible level. If someone comes in and chucks a 950 offer at me, do you think I'm going to snap their hand off and come running to you? I'm going to say, look, we've got 10 other offers on the table. We are driving this to close on Monday afternoon, and you need to come in with your best and final offer, and we're going to make sure that the best and final offer is what the property sells for. So we're not just guaranteeing to sell your home. We're also guaranteeing to get the best possible price that the market can produce. And that is something that we stand by.
I think that's something that people don't appreciate as well when they complain about the commission size, particularly when you talk about that kind of American, you know, 6%, 3%, that when you've got a UK agent at 1%, 0.75%, the difference on that 50 grand is neither here, at 0.75, it's neither here nor there. They just think, fuck it, I want to make the sale and get the 950. Whereas when you start to get to 2.5%, 3%, it starts to become a materially higher amount that actually just does genuinely impact on the agent's commission.
Well, also what I find is that it's not only just to protect the owner, but it's actually to protect the agent that's doing the job. So for me, you know, if I ring up an owner and I have one viewing in 3 weeks, and then that one viewing makes an offer of 940 on £1 million house, or it's worth around £1 million, my credibility in that negotiation process, it's not that high. The owner can easily turn around to me and say, well, you've only had one viewing in 3 weeks. This is the first offer. What I might do is just see what another agent can do, bring someone else in, we'll go multi-agency, that type of thing. When we put a process in place where we can say, right, it's had 15, 20, 30,000 views across different property platforms. We've had 46 inquiries that have come through in the space of 3 weeks. We had 24 people through the door. Here's all the feedback from all the buyers that were in the market. They've compared it to the other properties that it's again. They've said that they wouldn't pay this price for it because of this. The main road's a bit too close for it, so they wouldn't pay this price that you're looking for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right through to, right, now we're into the offers. The lowest offer, which was their best and final, was 975. We've got Mr. and Mrs. Smith, who've offered 985. And then we've got Mr. and Mrs. Khan, who are the absolute highest offer. This is their walkaway figure of 1,050,000. And the reason they've said that is because of X, Y, and Z, and this is why it's their best and final price. Here's our property data that we put you forward. It falls within the highest percentile of pound per square foot achieved in the area that your property is located in. The feedback also backs up the case. And what we do is, and what we train everyone to do in the business is not be a hit and run salesperson. You've got to treat it like you're a lawyer and you're presenting a case. So when we go and sit down with an owner and present an offer, we're not just saying, there's your offer. We're saying, here is all the evidence that's led up to that offer. Here's all the extenuating circumstances to why people won't pay the highest, as high as this buyer will. And here's how it led up to it. And then what happens is it holds so much weight that you can look at it, sit opposite an owner, and you can say, I've done my job. I've done my job. So now the ball's in your court.
Do you work in a particular geography or a particular price band?
I would say our average sale price is around 1.5 million. Okay. And we go, you know, we've done stuff recently at 7, 8, 9, 10 million. But like the...
But you're not interested in the 100 grand, 200 grand houses or...?
They do pop up, but it's more if they just come to us, we'll sell them. We don't go and prospect for them and look for them, no. I don't think we really prospect anything under 800,000 to 900,000 pounds.
So let's rewind again. You were working, you're out of prison, you're working for an estate agent at this point. You got your tag on.
Yeah.
When does the tag come off and when do you start your own business?
Yeah, so honestly, had the company I was at satisfied what I was looking for, I'd have probably still been there today. What had happened was my social media, I was like the first person to ever do these property tours, ever do the walkthrough tours and attract all of that that attention of luxury property and luxury tours on social media. So my Instagram started flying off. I was getting people wanting me to list their properties right across different parts of prime and super prime London. But this particular company were insistent that I operated within a certain geographical area of North London. So when I started going into different territories, they were saying, no, there's one of our other offices there. You have to pass it to that office. And I'm saying basically, no, that's not going to happen. And it was then that the clashing between me and head office kept happening because I wanted to expand. I wanted to grow a team. I wanted to expand, you know, very, very quickly. And I was. And they were putting limits on what I could do. And that was where I realized that this wasn't the right company for me. I looked around and searched around at other companies that could satisfy what I was looking for. And it just didn't exist. And what I ended up doing was creating a solution to my own problems. I had built a big enough kind of brand and name on social media that everybody sort of knew me in the industry. And I thought, well, I'll just do it. Even though I get a small team together and we just operate in different parts of London, I'll be really happy with that. I've done the maths on it. I know how many we need to sell. I know how many we need to do. But it exploded. We were over 100 agents within 6 months. And the reason was people wanted the flexibility. They wanted to be associated with an actual luxury real estate brand, not a low-end one. And of course, the social media was a massive attraction as well. And the combination of it all then just exploded. And we were doing massive business. We were selling properties kind of hand over fist. And I had then been approached by like 4 or 5 different production companies for what was an upcoming plan to launch a property television show in the UK. And then we got approached by one, which obviously went onto Channel 4 through all of that activity.
How long was that show on for?
It was only 3 episodes. If I'm honest, it got really, really good traction. It got good viewing numbers. It was big on social media. Every newspaper article was slating me, so that was good.
And no such thing as bad press.
Yeah. And what happened was we had a guy who was the producer in Channel 4, and he was a massive fan of mine, as in like for the way the direction of the show was. But in that industry, they are moving around a lot between different companies. They're always on contracts for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. He left. And then what happened was the show on episode 3 got handed to somebody who was literally called Karen. That was her name. And my face definitely didn't fit what she wanted at the 10 o'clock slot. And they moved us to midnight out of nowhere. And it was getting loads of traction. And then straight away, it was like, no, we're not going to be doing any more episodes with you. So it just fell into the wrong hands.
Well, I've not seen this show. So was it just you or were there other estate agents on there as well?
Just our company, Tyrone Ash Real Estate. And it was basically a journey of how we are this disruptive agency that's door knocking, prospecting aggressively in luxury areas in the UK. And we've got people earning 20, 30, 40, 50,000 pound a month in commission, doing big numbers. And it just kind of went from there really. And it was all like very young, very glamorous people with me being this aggressive real estate sales guy driving everyone. And of course that sort of got me a lot of good press and got me a lot of bad press.
And how much would it affect business the next day after the show had been on TV? Because I think this is something that, you know, people always have an opinion on, or people are always interested in, because they think, oh, I just need, if I could get on that TV show, it'll change my life. Or if this celebrity will wear my T-shirt, it'll blow up my clothing brand. And having been a bit around that world, you know, my experience of that is it never is that. You know, you get a little spike, but it's not going to change anybody's life. But, I mean, what was it like for you in the day or days after a show being on TV? I mean, was the phone blowing up? Or
so it's a really good question, because I'm in agreement with you. I actually said to everybody involved in the show, don't expect this to change your life. It's just good publicity. That's why I was as controversial as possible. I wanted to get as many newspaper and headlines as possible, just so that we were talked about. I played the bad guy, the villain, to do that, but it works. We did get a lot of press on it. Everyone in the industry knew who we were. We got a lot of listings, but we were getting a lot of listings anyway. You know, we had worked so hard on our social media content and what we were doing and how many properties we were selling, and we were that disruptive, edgy company that was upsetting and rattling the cages a little bit. And that's kind of what our angle was. That's how we got the show in the first place. So that just exaggerated that. We weren't like a nothing company that was banking on this show to get us to where we wanted to go. This was just a bit of icing on the cake for us, and it worked, and it did. And still to this day, people come to me in Dubai when I'm in a bar or a, you know, a restaurant, and they say, oh yeah, I watched your show and all this. It was very well watched, and it was, people I think did want to see another series. It was one of those things where my face and our face didn't fit the person who was making the decision, even though the decision was already made. And I think they lost out on a lot of good footage that would have gone into the next series.
Given, I guess, that you're in the social media world now anyway, is it never something that you fancied almost like producing yourself?
I think what's happening in Dubai is absolutely staggering in such a short time. So we've got a team of now 40 agents that we've built in around 6-7 months. The UK is absolutely, you know, flying as well. I think now Dubai is off the ground, and we've got people hitting some big, big numbers in there. I think I would be open to doing it, but I'd need to team up with the right production company, because for me, I feel like I've seen, I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I've seen some of the shows that have come out of Dubai, the property shows. I was very like unimpressed with them. I just think that, you know, it's not edgy enough. It's very, very corporate. And, you know, that unfortunately doesn't make for good television. It doesn't mean that you've got to be obnoxious. It just means that there's got to be some bigger personalities in there that are going to like really grab viewing figures. Because after selling Sunset, it was really a battle to hold that attention on property shows. And I did say, this was why when we were getting the show, I was urgently trying to get the show out, because there was a couple of other companies that had got deals with other channels. And I said, we've got to be the first, because otherwise when you miss it, it's going to be an imitation of some other rubbish ones. And we got out first, that got the most attention. Then you had some other ones coming out in the UK that were just absolutely diabolical. They were so boring. And of course, I knew most of the agents in them, and I know they haven't sold a house between them.
Any juicy gossip or great scenes that ended up on the cutting room floor? Any, you know, secrets from the show that you can share that have never made it out?
Good question. I mean, I can tell you now, there was some fallouts on the show that were some pretty heavy fallouts, and I think people did ask us like,
Are they real?
And I can tell you they were.
Like, and that's what, between like you and your staff? Or
yeah,
your staff
there was,
and
there
each
was
other?
Some arguments between staff in there. And it was, I mean, there was one scene and two people were going at it. And after the cameras went off, like the girl's gone off in tears. And I'm thinking, this is a little bit too realistic.
Where's HR at this point? Yeah?
It was crazy. And then I remember, because I got hammered for this speech I did at the awards. And I was a good couple of, you know, bottles of Laurent Perrier deep. So I was like, you know, enjoying myself up there. And I think I just rattled on, and I was very conscious the TV cameras were there. So I extended it as long as possible to give them as much as possible. But when I watched it back, I thought, oh my God, I was pretty drunk when I did that.
Tell me, I forgot to ask you earlier, when you first started your own business, was that on the 2.5% commission model that you're doing now, or has the business kind of morphed and changed along the way?
If I'm honest, we started off just grabbing whatever we could. So I'm not going to dress it up any more than that. I think that we knew the process. I was teaching people who were very, very rough around the edges as well. So if we could nick, you know, a 400 grand house that was in East London and do it for 1%, we'd do it. We were just trying to get the wheels moving, and we were picking stuff up all around London, all around surrounding areas and cities. But after around 4 months, 5 months, the plan was, and I sort of got everyone together. I said, right, you've all kind of got warmed up now. We're transitioning into the luxury end of the market. That's where this business has to go. I just wanted you to find your feet and get some experience. But now I don't want you prospecting anything under 800,000. Our fee is 2.5%. And we also charge £1,000 up front for marketing.
Did that turn people off? As in some of the agents, did some of them say, you know, it's bridge too far?
Yeah, people were like, you can't do that. Everyone charges 1%. In my area, the classic line is, but in my area, all the agents charge 1%. And I said, no, that's every area. So that's every area. Your area is not special. That's every area. And it's your job to determine exactly why someone needs to pay you 150% more and why you're going to get them 150% better result or a better service or whatever the, you know, that you're talking about. So it still is a common objection to come up with. But I think for me, like, I got so used to having that conversation. I remember when I was fully operating as an agent, someone would say, I want to pay 1%, and I would just laugh because it was so ridiculous in my head that you think I'm going to sell your £1 million house for 10 grand. Like, that is nuts. That is absolutely bonkers. If you want my honest opinion, you're getting away with murder at 2.5%. I think it should be 5%.
I mean, I don't know how people make a business out of it at 1%. And no. I mean, I know it's not your thing, but the rental model is even fucking worse.
I mean,
10% probably.
Oh, it's peanuts.
But by the time you take the cost of the letting out, which is probably about 5% of it, isn't it?
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
And it's then on the management fee. How can you possibly manage that property and keep the lights on for that money?
Well, it's crazy because I had like senior people in our business going, we need to do lettings. And I got swayed. I got this woman in to do lettings. She was a specialist in it. And I was seeing these numbers like £50 profit, £80 profit. I thought, I've just spent 400 quid on my lunch. This is not sustainable. Like, we need like about 1,000 properties for this to be worthwhile. And I'm probably going to have 50 staff to manage the 1,000 properties. Like, it doesn't make sense. So one of the things that works for us as a business and what many businesses can't replicate is my spend and my money goes into automating and connecting the business, but we don't actually have physical offices. So what I don't have is agents congregating around the water cooler, wasting time and talking rubbish.
You don't have any physical offices?
No offices. And that allows me to not have lettings because realistically, when you break down the model of an estate agency, you break down the model of a real estate company, the reason they have lettings is to get quick cash in to keep the lights on. All the real money is done through sales. And what they'll do is they'll potentially, I think I did some research that the average real estate company, certainly in Dubai, lettings is only responsible for about 10% of their revenue. And then if you think about how much their office costs, probably costs them about 10 to 20% of their revenue. It's just designed to keep the lights on.
So is your model back in the UK, do the agents, are they commission only?
Yes.
And are they kind of agents, or is it more like a franchise of their own business, if you like, or do they happen to operate under your umbrella and rules?
They operate under the umbrella and the rules. Tyrone Ash International is the brand. They have their personal name, brand, whatever you want to call it, which is in partnership with Tyrone Ash International. So we call it a partnership. It's a 50-50 split, 50-50 on the revenue. We provide the training, the CRM system, the marketing platforms. We even edit and produce their content for them. We help them grow their personal brand. We do everything that they
need.
Giving
them the leads as well.
So leads is another conversation because the leads come from a multitude of areas. They've got a database of 40, 50,000 people they can work through, which they can, you know, call leads, call vendors, book market appraisals. We will also demand, especially in the UK, that they door knock and they prospect and they do aggressive prospecting to get listings. And then, of course, we distribute leads that are incoming from the business. So we get a lot of market appraisal requests. We get a lot of buyer leads, buyer requests as well. And it's the same for Dubai.
And they're just distributed evenly, or you do a worse commission split if you give them the lead?
No, it's just we're given the lead on the basis and they'll still get the 50-50 commission split. The person who won't get the lead is the person who's doing fuck all. They won't get anything. But the people who are working, doesn't even mean even if they haven't billed any money really, but they're working hard, they will get leads.
What's your average agent earning and how long does it take them to get there?
I would say people in the first year earn around £80,000 to £150,000 who work.
Has to be three times more than it'd be earning if they're working for a high street firm.
Easily. And funny enough, usually 70-80% of that is done in the back 6 months. Well, because it takes a while to get the listings
build the
live.
Reputation, yeah, exactly, build the brand.
Yeah. So
what's your top agent earning?
We've got a few that are going to clear £500,000 this year.
Really?
Yeah.
Net to them?
Yeah, net. We've got people well on track to do a mil.
And when they're getting to that level, how do you convince them or what's the sell for them to not go off on their own? Because obviously at that point, they're clearly a talented person. Yeah. They've got some fat on the back to be able to invest in their own business if that's what they wanted to do. How do you convince them not to give away £500,000 to you?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's all about the route you want to go down. Because for me, when I was an agent and I was earning lots of money, I was earning lots of money doing what I loved, which was listing and selling houses.
Running a business.
Exactly. When you want to transition over, then you become an operational person. You become involved in all the HR. You become involved in the recruitment. You become involved in the paying the bills and all that unfun stuff. And now you're not doing the stuff that you're good at. So first of all, there is a 12-month non-compete in the business. So they have to get through that. The second thing is that, for me, you've got to just pick the route that you want to go down. At the end of the day, you decide, do you want to list and sell houses? Some of the biggest real estate agents are turning over millions in America and in Australia, and they're part of a brokerage. And the reason they're part of that brokerage is because they don't want to do the operational stuff. They just want to list and sell houses. And so does their team, and they build and they grow that to the highest level possible. So what we do is stage two. Stage two is an experienced agent who is billing lots of money, who is now a large figure within the business. They become what we call a senior partner. They run an entire team. They have a hand in the recruitment side of things. They lead their team. They hold their morning meetings. And they basically are the people that are the go-to people in the business for their team. So they get a profit share on what the entire team bills. And it's effectively them running their own business within the business.
How does someone qualify to be that? They've got to have hit a certain amount of sales, have they?
I usually make a judgment call, and it used to be a black and white qualification process, but now it's actually based on a judgment of whether that person, first of all, geographically is in the right area for where we need someone. Secondly, their performance is on a trajectory where we know they're going to, even if they've not quite hit it, they're going to hit it. Or they have just consistently been hitting and they're really looking for that next level up. But the good thing is with the business is we'll make the call to them before they make the call to us.
What's the most expensive house you've ever sold back in the UK?
12 million is the highest one.
Okay.
Yeah, 12 million is the highest one. We've done a few at 8 and 9, and then we've done a load at 5 and 4 and 6.
The higher the price gets, I mean, do they become materially harder or different to selling? Because I guess the market of buyers is thinner, or is it just, you know, right house on the right day, right buyer? There's no real answer.
Yeah, it's I think you're on to the right sort of angle there. When it comes to a property that's at £10 million, there is not a queue of buyers that you're really looking for a one-to-one buyer match on it. And I think in Dubai, what you'll see a massive difference of is that as it gets over a certain price point, these houses are just getting sold through WhatsApp. Like people are not doing, there's not many massive videos going out. People want it to be private. If they've got a property that's worth, you know, 10 million, 15 million, 20 million US dollars, they don't want it smashed around Property Finder and social media. And some do and will do it, but some don't. And I think that is the culture in Dubai. In the UK, it tends to be advertised and they tend to be happy for it to sit there for a while. But you've got to know where that buyer's coming from. It's usually that one viewing, one buyer that comes in and they'll be happy to take it on the day.
So you mentioned Property Finder, you mentioned Dubai. How long have you been here now? What brought you over?
Yeah, so I've been in Dubai around 12 months, literally this month. Our business has been live about 7 months. And quite frankly, I came over because it was the natural expansion for the business. Our model is very similar to, on a commission basis, to what they are over here in Dubai. I was coming on holiday four times a year here, so it just naturally was getting ran down my throat as I come off the aeroplane. And I had a lot of requests of people saying, are you opening in Dubai? I'd love to come and work with you when you do that in Dubai. So there was just a lot of factors that made it an easy decision to make. And so before I knew it, I was on a one-way flight over here launching it and thought, God, it's actually happening.
I mean, I was going to ask if you found any cultural differences, let's say business cultural and business model cultural, coming to Dubai from the UK. But I guess I'm kind of answering my own question. I would imagine it would have been more culturally problematic taking a Dubai model back to the UK, because your UK model really is very unusual for the UK anyway. Mm. And you're already doing what they're doing over here.
Yeah, it migrated quite easy in the, you know, the commission structure is very, very similar. But what you don't realize, and what a lot of people don't realize, is that the similarities between how they're running Dubai agencies versus the UK is more similar than you think. So as much as you don't have the high street offices and all that sort of stuff, within these large real estate corporations, you have mini high street offices within the organization. The reason we're getting such an influx of real estate brokers wanting to leave these companies and come to us, we've got around 50 interviews this week. We are,
this is Dubai,
just Dubai, Dubai, just Dubai, in real estate brokerages in Dubai, interested in coming to work at Tyron Ash International. The reason being is if you join one of these companies, they will say to you, right, you're allowed to operate in that area only, just like the high street offices that we were talking about earlier. You can only do lettings, or you can only do sales in that area. And if you get, say you're working in, I don't know, the Palm, and then that same guy comes up to you and says, oh, by the way, I've got a penthouse to sell in downtown. Well, it's only 20 minutes, half an hour up the road. Why can you not do it? But you're not allowed. You have to send it over to the downtown agent. So now you've lost that connection with the client. And then you'll get a very small referral fee when that person sells it and earns a fortune off your listing with your client. And what's happening is a lot of the brokers are very sick of that process. So that's why they're coming over.
And that, and also, I mean, it doesn't make sense from a trust relationship perspective either, because, you know, you want to deal with that agent because you know them. I mean, if you're going to get palmed off on someone else, you may as well go and find a new person, the person that you like yourself. I mean, I always have this conversation back in the UK with like lawyers and accountants and things, and people always go, oh, you know, what law firm do you use? And I said, well, for me, I don't use a law firm, I use a lawyer. Yeah. And it's that particular lawyer. Now, I don't care whether he's at that firm works for himself. You know, I want to work with that particular person. Mm. But then when I ring him up and say, can you do this job? And they're like, oh, I can't because I'm busy for whatever reason. But let me introduce you to my colleague. In the old days, I'd used to obviously take the referral, but nowadays I say, you know what, if you can't do it, don't bother giving me the referral.
Yeah.
Because I've got other people that I can go to as my second choice or third choice. Mm-hmm. But it's such a relationship led business, you know, the law, the accountancy, the real estate, that, yeah, I mean, it just makes absolutely no sense to force your salespeople to burn a relationship and palm it off on somebody
else. That
is
the system, and it's nuts for me. So for me, I just think to myself, it's hard enough finding that client who's ready to do business, who's ready to give you the houses to sell, who's ready to invest in off plan, whatever it is they want to do. You have the ability, it's not rocket science, you have the ability to service whatever those needs are. If that person wants to go and dump $5 million in Ras Al Khaimah because they want some apartments near the casino, that is not rocket science. You can do it. Set the group up, set the chat up, set the Zoom up, do what you need to do and get the thing closed. Then if they turn around a day later and say, oh, by the way, I've got a 50 million villa to sell on the Palm, guess what? Jump in your car and go and fucking sell it. It's not difficult. Like, for me, Dubai is like it's a very small geographical location compared to a lot of others. You've got a lot of condensed business and a condensed millionaires and billionaires within one space. And you don't need to specialize in one geographical location. You need to specialize in servicing the client.
Any particular stories of failed sales or anything that's gone very wrong or that you've had to step in and fix or that was unfixable and you wanted to string an agent up for it?
I think, if I'm honest, the everything's been going pretty smoothly at the moment. What we have had is I had a very, very wealthy client who was from the UK. He was at the final stages of dumping around £25 million into a very large off-plan deal. Couldn't get his head around the fact that getting in early meant that he was going to make substantial amounts of profit based on the trajectory of where everything was going. Plus, he was getting X amount of discount. He just thought, anywhere I go in the UK, if I put this much money down, I get 30, 40% discount. And, you know, explanation after explanation, he just couldn't get his head around it, wouldn't do it. That was a very frustrating negotiation because I think I spent about 5 hours on that one. But, you know, that's just part of the job. I don't hinder any, you know, problems with that.
And while we've been talking numbers over the last, you know, hour or so, you've been talking to big numbers. I mean, you're dropping 25 billion here, 5 billion there, 10 million there. I mean, for people listening to this back in the UK, you know, if they're outside of London, I think getting their heads around a number bigger than £1 million is probably hard enough, you know, to start to think about 10 million, 25 and plus. And, you know, there's plenty of places in Dubai, 25 million plus. Talk to me a bit about the Dubai market as a place to park your investment money. You know, where do you think it's going and why has it gotten to where it is?
Yeah, it's a brilliant question because one of the things I really had to research was not just can you make money in Dubai, but how exactly are you going to make that money? Where exactly is it going to come from? Because we've all heard the stories of people who bought a plot of land on the Palm for £700,000 and now it was worth 25 million dirham and all they did was buy the plot and sit on it. Just the same as there's probably apartments in downtown that people have had the same story with. That is the extreme example of how you can ride the market and make maximum profit. But where the expertise comes in and the advice comes in is the people who really have their finger on the pulse. They will advise on exactly where the next phases of that growth are coming. So there will be different announcements, there'll be different launches, there'll be different infrastructure being built, there'll be different attractions. And then you've got to think to yourself, right, well, in 2 or 3 years' time, when that all goes live, if you're someone who's held real estate at a very early stage, then as that all gets built up and the media frenzy happens and all of that, you're going to be the person that then gains a lot of capital growth through that purchase. So that's how we're advising people heavily is we're not, you know, one of the things you'll notice with anyone, maybe when you land in Dubai for the first time, what struck me was how many towers there were. And I just thought, how am I going to get my head around this? From a real estate perspective, this is a lot. Then you realize when you actually hone it down to where you're going to be advising people and where they're going to make their money, you end up narrowing down to about 5 areas or 6 areas, and it's very easy. So it's about being that trusted person, that knowledgeable, credible individual that can show somebody with evidence that if they put their money in X, then when it sells after this amount of time, you're going to make Y, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how you kind of map it out.
And how is the market holding? Because, I mean, again, for context for anyone listening or watching this, we're in March 2024. I mean, you know, I've heard a lot of, you know, so murmuring over the last few months that things are getting tougher to sell at the top end. Mm-hmm. You know, things are pulling back a bit. You know, buyers are less aggressive. Any commentary on that?
I think that buyers are less aggressive. I think what's happening now is you're seeing a bit of stagnancy with regards to how volatile it is. We all know that there was a large influx of Russian money that came over. So people were just, I mean, coming over and buying and buying and buying, and people were just picking the phone up and becoming a millionaire as a real estate agent. It was crazy. So what's happening is less of that. And now what's happening is the market in itself is kind of, I would say, leveling out and it's stabilizing. Because what you're seeing now is not Dubai just being sold as one big off-plan vision, which is what it kind of was before. What you're now seeing is communities being built, infrastructure being built, schools, and everything else around it, plus the attractions. And so when that happens, what you've got is a very, very deep-rooted secondary market. You've got people who are now climbing the property ladder there, trying to, you know, get to a better house, move up the ladder, do all these different things. That stabilizes the top of the market because it all has to correlate. It all has to be in sync with each other. You can't just have these levels of houses selling for this and then there's a big jump and then this is just keep going to the moon. It's got to stabilize so people can climb the ladder and hit. And I just feel like for me, prices around like the Palm, they've stayed the same for a while now. They kept climbing and climbing and climbing. I think they may even come down slightly. They may just stabilize a bit more. I don't know. And then you've got the kind of volatility that's happened in some of the new projects that have come up. I mean, for example, like Emar Beachfront, that spiked. You know, those two beds were selling in 2017 off plan for like £450,000. You could sell a two bed for £800,000-£900,000 now in English money. So doubled your money in like 4 or 5 years. So people who bought a lot of them are going to be laughing. And I think that people are just looking for those opportunities, which they are there. And we've got a lot of people making a lot of money in these things, but they're not everywhere, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And but how, I think one thing I've always found Dubai's been good at, because you know, I bought my house probably about 3 years ago now, my apartment three and a bit years ago. And, you know, it was still, I mean, when you talk now, people just go, oh, you know, you bought early, you've done well. But I mean, even back then, you know, people are still saying, well, you know, prices were kind of high. And my view was always, look, I'm buying this for myself. I'm not, you know, so I'm not trying to be clever, not trying to be a real estate investor. You know, I mean, I bought it cheap because I'd negotiated very, very aggressively on it. But I always felt that I was going to live in it for a long time. Mm-hmm. So if the price went up, down, I didn't really care.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to be in it for the long term. And, you know, as prices have gone up now, it's more of a talking point for people of, you know, well, how long can these prices possibly keep going on for? But I think what I've found Dubai, or, you know, the UAE in general, has been very good at is always finding some new story to keep that going along. Yeah. You know, just when you think everything's going to fall off, the Russians come. You know, just when every Russian has brought as much money as he possibly can, you think, well, it's going to fall off now. They decide to legalize gambling, you know. Yeah. and then I'm sure when the casino rush is finished, you know, there'll be the next thing and the next thing. And look, you know, yes, okay, it might not keep it going to the moon like you say, but it's doing a very good job of, you know, keeping that plateau solid or keeping the landing as soft as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. That is one of the things that I'm so attracted to about Dubai is when you look at, first of all, what's been built, and then you look at what the plans are to be built, they're not even like 25% done. It's like the plans are absolutely insane. And then when you think about everything that's going out past Maidan towards Palm Jebel Ali, you've got Al Maktoum Airport, you've got a bigger mall going in, you've got Ras Al Khaimah with the casino island that's going to be bigger than Las Vegas. And that's just what we know about. And then you think about, what don't we know about? What's coming?
They just need to fix the fucking traffic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the flying cars are coming in 2026, aren't they? So I'll let you try them out first.
Talk to me about personal brand. I mean, obviously, it's something you know, something that you've got a great personal brand of. You know, you teach it to your agents, so you know you obviously see the value in it. I mean, you know, for the people listening who haven't quite bought into the personal branding train yet, you know, why should they be doing it, and what are the benefits of having a strong personal brand?
Building a personal brand is a long game. The reason most people won't do it is because they won't see the initial benefit of it for maybe 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, maybe 5 years. What it is a slow burner that builds people's trust with you as an individual and with the businesses that you represent. So what I really like is that I'd say most days now, someone will stop me somewhere and say, I love your videos, I love your content, I love your business, whatever it might be. And it's really nice to know that that reach is actually happening in real time. So when I put a value on that, I think to myself, what are the benefits of that? Okay, so someone says, I like your content. Well, that's not really the purpose of it. What the purpose of it is that there is credibility and trust built within that. So what's the ripple effect of that? Well, the ripple effect of that is that someone might know someone who refers someone who is going to list a house with us, and they go, oh yeah, I know that guy. He's on social media, or he's on Instagram, or whatever it might be. Or I watch the TV show, or they're selling loads of houses, or, you know, he's a bit outspoken, but watch some of his podcasts, whatever it might be. It's kind of like the whole thing marries up as your digital interview, your digital CV. And people now can tell more about you through your social media than meeting you in person. That's what the ironic thing about it is. You could spend an hour with someone, shake their hand, and you'd have to take everything they say to you on face value, and they could spin you any story they want, Well, you could go onto their Instagram and you could see what they've been up to for the last 2-3 years. And you could pretty much have an accurate window of what type of person they are, where they socialize, who they hang around with, how they dress, what they do for work, what they do for business, all through a picture gallery that's on social media.
And the amount of people that I've had to fire and then gone and seen the social media afterwards and said, fucking hell, if only I'd have looked at this 6 months ago or 12 months ago, I would never have hired them in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, and I think as well, something people always miss with personal branding is you already have a personal brand. You know, when they say, oh, I'm not into all that personal branding mm-hmm. business, you already have a personal brand anyway. Yeah. It's just a question of how much do you want to amplify it?
Mm, absolutely. And I think as well, people say, I don't like doing videos. I don't like the camera. No, like I've got news for you. Like nobody likes doing videos. Nobody likes the camera. You do it because it's necessary. And also that kind of bodes in with the fact that anything that's worth having isn't, you don't do it because you want to do it. You do it because you have to do it. It's a necessary evil on the bigger scheme of things. And unfortunately, if we all had the luxury of doing everything we wanted whenever we wanted, then nothing would ever get done because that's just not how things are achieved.
And like you said, well, it's marketing at scale. You might not like making videos, but I'm sure you'll ultimately grow to like making videos a lot more than you like making 200 cold calls a day. You
know, pick
your poison.
Of course. And I think that, you know, it's just necessary. I just will not ever tolerate someone who doesn't see the benefit in it. They're not welcome in our business. For me, they must do social media. They must build their personal brand. They must talk to their audience. They must build their engagement. Because if someone's going to go and list and sell a house with them, then first of all, they're going to want to know they're attached to an established business. I think we tick that box pretty well. We've got credibility. We've got a lot of property that we've sold in, you know, the millions of pounds and all of this. But what about the agent that's just knocked on the door? What about the agent that's just called them? Let me just check them out. Oh, okay. They're talking about the market. They've got some amazing properties they've sold. They're doing some really cool property tours. And they're talking about some success stories they've had with other clients. Looks good. Let's go with them. Or land on the page. There's absolutely nothing there. There's a picture of their dog and just launched in real estate or just started my real estate career. It's like, they're probably not the agent for us.
Do you take on like complete real estate virgins if they're prepared to, you know, follow your program and learn from the master, or do people have to have some degree of experience already before they come?
No, I think some of the greatest success stories we've had in the business are people with absolutely zero experience. One of the funny things I've noticed is that sometimes people with too much experience become, they're so long in the tooth that it's so hard to mold them into
anything
different.
Well, they want to argue with your principles and tell you why they know better, yet they still haven't performed.
It's true, literally. And, you know, it's very frustrating when you're not trying to have a discussion as to why social media is important. You're just trying to get them to get the result out of social media. So if you have to then expend that energy, explain to someone why personal brand, why doing social media is important. All of that is wasted energy when we could have just been talking about the type of content you should have been producing, the results that come from it, and everything that's attached to it. So, you know, having people who are too set in their ways is a problem, but they have, I think what we're looking for is the skill set. We're not looking for the experience. We're looking for the type of personality. If people interview with us and they're too introvert, and they're not asking questions and they don't seem proactive and their energy's low, they're not going to get a second interview. If people are saying, look, I haven't got the experience, but I've wanted to do this my whole life. I've been researching real estate videos. I've been watching your podcast. I am raring to go. I'll knock the doors. I'll make the calls. I'll do the videos. Just get me in there. I'll be like, get this guy started now. But, you know, it's like, it's all about that type of person they bring, because I would rather have a hard worker with the right attitude and a lower skill set than someone who's got all the skills at their disposal, but they're just lazy.
Is there anything that you would absolutely not let your agents do? I'm sure there's many things, but insofar as like when it comes to building their brand, for example, if I want to come and be an agent for you, can I have my own podcast? Can I do that as long as I'm doing it under the Tyron Ash brand? I can do what I want.
There's absolutely no limitations. In fact, the more the better. We've got people who've had articles done in newspapers. We've had people who have done podcasts. We've got people who are just happy to do their property content themselves and property tours and all that sort of stuff. You know, there is absolutely no limitations. The funny thing is that what you're looking for really, especially in real estate, is you're not doing a high volume sale. So we're not interested in people buying 1,000 of something. What we're interested in is that one client, that one person who clicks on a video, clicks on a post and just says, I like this person. Let me buy with them. Let me sell with them. Let me form a business relationship with them. And that is the idea of it. So that might be that they just saw a house that you advertised and thought, oh, that's a nice property, or, oh, well, that's a good sale they've done. And then actually what they do is it's the second video that comes up where you're talking about the market, or you're talking about a recent client experience, and they go, okay, the two have married together, I'm going to send them a DM. And that's usually how it happens. It's usually on multiple points of interaction where people will feel that they know you and they build that trust. So the more things people can do to contribute that, we will serve and support that as much as possible as a business. And if everyone plays within the rules, then everyone will win.
Listen, Tyrone, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here, mate.
Pleasure.
So many different and interesting avenues that we've gone down, and so much value for the guys watching and listening to take away. Before you go, give yourself obviously a little shout out of where people can come and find you on social, on the web, and how they can apply for a job, and also close it out with your top tip for anyone coming to interview with the King of Real Estate. You know, what's one thing every real estate agent needs to know?
Brilliant. Yeah. So Tyrone Ash Official is my personal page. Tyrone Ash International is the business page. I've also launching my e-learning platform, Broke to Boss, which is basically a blueprint of success that people can start from absolutely ground zero and start building their life to potentially becoming a millionaire. When it comes to real estate, for me, the one massive piece of advice I could give with anybody is you have to be self-development driven. You have to want to learn. I'm a student of the industry now. Anything I can pick up, whether it's from an agent within the business, whether it's from a video I watch, an audio book, a course, whatever it might be, I will be absorbing to become better at the job, better in the business, and better all round. And I think if you're driven by that, plus you have an extremely high work rate, those things will all kind of marry up to a successful formula. If you are looking for immediate gratification, real estate is not the career for you. This is the career where you could work 3, 4, 5 months, get nothing, and then on month 6, you could earn £100,000. That's just how it works, especially in your first year.
And I think that's great advice that can be applied to, you know, to most businesses and you know, most industries, and certainly when it comes to the student side of things. I mean, it's frightening how many people, the vast majority of people gave up learning long ago. So listen, mate, it's been a pleasure having you here. Love listening, love learning myself, and hope we can do it again sometime.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Matt. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Stripping Off with Matt Haycox. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this week's episode, but please remember to subscribe or to follow, and please, please leave a review. If you can leave a review, that's how we move up the algorithm, that's how we get to the top of the charts, and that's how I can keep bringing you bigger and better guests that you'll love each week. Have you got any suggestions for guests? Have you got any burning questions you want to ask? Well, slide into my DMs on social at Stripping Off with Matt Haycox.